This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We have an exciting show today. I hope you'll find it enlightening and helpful and inspiring. We're going to talk about a big week in Jerusalem this past week. Dr. Elat Mazar announced her discovery of the seal of the prophet Isaiah. Her phone's been ringing off the hook. We're going to get a behind-the-scenes scoop on that. Also, an update on what our students of Herbert W. Armstrong College have been digging up during the current phase of archaeology they're involved in there. And meanwhile, the White House announced it plans to move the American Embassy to Jerusalem, not in a few years, not by next year, but by May 14th of this year. And to top it all off, our crew in Jerusalem grew by one member as our man over there, Brent Noctegal, and his wife, Michelle, had the birth of their new son. So we're going to talk about all of that with Brent, a very exciting interview with him. We also have an interview with registered holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian about a significantly less pleasant subject, food poisoning. Perhaps you've enjoyed a tasty meal at a restaurant only to find yourself flat on your back for a couple of days. It's a more common problem than you might think. We're going to talk about why it happens and steps you can take to reduce your risk of it. I'll also share another one of the student speeches from our recent Herbert W. Armstrong College speech banquet, this one from a freshman at the college, Gianni Welsh. He gave a lesson about why it's important to reach out to the reclusive kid at the back of the room. So we have lots to look forward to on the show today, but we're going to start with a story about how China's moves toward totalitarianism lurched forward this past Sunday with a move that will set Xi Jinping up to become emperor for life. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. The groundwork is being laid for Chinese President Xi Jinping to rule indefinitely. On Sunday, China's ruling Communist Party proposed scrapping term limits for the president. We at the Trumpet have been watching the development of strongmen on the world stage, and this is one of the most stunning examples out there. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hi there.
So tell us about what's currently in China's constitution and then the process that would be required to change it, as we heard announced this last Sunday.
Sure, yes. Well, after Mao Zedong became a real dictator to the detriment of millions of Chinese people, the subsequent leaders enacted kind of a collective system of leadership, and they also included a 2 5-year term limit for the paramount leader or the president. So basically it says after a leader has served his 2 5-year terms, he has to go on and make room for someone else. And that would, you know, that was designed to avoid a repetition of that Mao era where one man takes total power under his to himself, basically. And then there's no checks and balances. There's nothing to regulate his human nature and emotions and things like that. That's what's in the Constitution now, which most countries have. Almost all countries say you can't just be president for life. Here are the number of years that you're allowed to rule. Some of them will have 2 consecutive terms are all that's allowed. Some will say 2 total are all that's allowed. And that's what the existing Chinese constitution says.
So what would it take to change it? Now the party says they've proposed doing away with this, which
yes,
might mean something a little different than being proposed in other countries.
That's exactly right. What that means is that in March, this proposal will go to the legislator to be voted on. But this is essentially a rubber stamp parliament. Anything that the Chinese Communist Party sends through to be voted on or anything like that, it's pretty much always passed. So there's very little reason at this point to think that this rubber stamp parliament wouldn't pass this measure. It's very unlikely that it wouldn't be passed.
Mm-hmm. So this being the case, and this is something that has been kind of on the horizon, that people have been speculating this is going to happen just with Xi Jinping taking more power to himself in recent years and even recent months. How are the Chinese people responding to this announcement?
Well, you know, I've been on some online forums for geopolitical discussion, and you do see a few Chinese people on those forums. Generally, they have to use VPNs or virtual private networks to access parts of the internet like that that are normally blocked in China. And those who have access to these forums, there's a lot of concern and there's a lot of disappointment in Xi Jinping. There's a lot of people saying, this is scary. We don't know what our government's becoming. But I would say that these are the unusual Chinese citizens, the ones who break through the firewall to discuss geopolitics with Westerners and things like that. For the most part, what the Chinese people care about is stability. They want growth. They want prosperity for themselves and their families. They would like to see China kind of regain its what they view as its rightful role as a world leader, as a powerful, respected nation. And so for the most part, the citizens and the elite in the government are behind this because they view the world right now as becoming very unstable. There's a number of factors happening. You see the rise of extreme right and left parties and politics in Europe. You see, the election of President Trump in the U.S. has brought a lot of instability as the U.S. is kind of retreating. There's Brexit happening there in Europe. There's a lot of factors right now that have people concerned. What has been the existing order is shaking. And so the Chinese people are fixated on stability and on avoiding any kind of uncertainty and risk. And really, Xi is kind of the symbolic figure at the center of stability, at least for China. And he's the person whose leadership their stability hangs on. So for the most part, I think the people are supportive of it. They say he's done pretty well. The world is entering an uncertain time, and we are in favor of him, you know, staying at the helm there so that we can have a measure of stability during this turbulent era.
Well, that is very interesting to think about the public support that Xi would have for this move. I want to talk a little bit about some of the reports that we are seeing about how the government is having to squash dissent, maybe from those who are using the VPN in order to engage with Westerners about this, that there are people who are concerned within the country. I heard one person who said on a forum somewhere, wow, we're becoming basically like North Korea, or we're becoming more like our neighbor. Maybe you could just talk about some of the steps that the government is taking to ensure that dissent doesn't spread.
Yes. There have been some crackdowns on specific search terms, such as two-term limit in mm-hmm. China. Now, if you search for that, what you're going to get are a lot of, inside of China, if you search for that, you'll get a long list of articles that are government approved that say, this has never been a firm guideline, and now it's being removed for the good of the Chinese people, for the good of the stability of the country. And basically, it's a lot of pro-government propaganda that is replacing some initial articles that popped up saying, this is a little bit alarming. And there were some comparisons made by Chinese analysts to the North Korean government and things like that. But the government quickly came in there. We hear a lot about the Great Wall of China, but there's also the Great Firewall of mm-hmm. China, where they block out any sort of online content that doesn't conform to the government message, basically. And so they cracked down pretty quickly and resolutely on articles that kind of questioned this and that drew comparisons between more authoritarian regimes elsewhere in the world. And they just started to publish all these very pro Xi Jinping articles.
So if you wouldn't mind reminding us about what we were talking about last October, that was when the China convened that Congress where they implemented some of these changes to the Constitution that had some people concerned or basically saying, wow, he's just one step away from making himself emperor for life.
Yeah, sure. This was October. The Chinese Communist Party held its 19th National Congress. That happens every 5 years. And that marked the end of Xi Jinping's first 5-year term. And so normally, once a Chinese leader completes his first 5-year term, that's when he and the Chinese Communist Party name his successor. And so then he goes on to complete his second five-year term, and that's when the man who was named those 5 years earlier becomes the new leader. That's how it's gone for decades in China. But in October, when Xi's first five-year term ended, he neglected to name a successor. And at that time, a lot of China watchers were saying, that's alarming. That is a that's a signal that he probably doesn't plan to step down. At that time, The Trumpet wrote an article called Xi Jinping, Emperor for Life? And part of that article says, quote, Xi's decision not to name a successor at the 19th Congress strongly indicates that he has no plans to relinquish power at the 20th Congress in 2022. This would give him an unprecedented third term and position him to rule China for the rest of his life. So that was back in October. And now as of Sunday, we can see that this was the correct read on that decision not to name a successor. And we see that he very likely could be emperor for life. So we could possibly remove the question mark when we write about this emperor for life trend in articles going forward.
So as much as observers have been watching this and concerned that this is what's going to happen, certainly the direction is clear. But this notion that basically he's enjoying the support of the majority of his people. And you're talking about a nation with, what, 1.2 billion people, something along those lines? 1.3 billion?
1.4 now, actually.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So that's an enormous amount of, I mean, popular support kind of has a different meaning when you're talking about a country of that size. Why would this be important for us to pay attention to, prophetically speaking?
Well, the Trumpet watches Xi Jinping's tightening grip on power because Bible prophecy does reveal that as America's influence and power declines in the end time, two different power blocks will emerge to take its place. One of those is a German-led European power kind of operating in the tradition of the Holy Roman Empire. And the second one is an Asian bloc, called in scripture the kings of the East. And scripture makes clear that it's headed by Russia, but that China is in kind of a secondary position of leadership in this Asian bloc. And the Bible makes really clear in chapters such as Jeremiah 50 and 51, Daniel 11 and 12, and Revelation 16, that a clash between this European power and this Russo-Chinese-led Asian bloc will end in the most violent conflict in human history. The Bible talks quite a lot about that. And so the fact that Xi Jinping is now positioned to be emperor for life, basically, is really significant in terms of those prophecies, because his ongoing rise, his increasing control over China's military and its foreign policy, it's all just really vital to watch, because it indicates how Xi Jinping could fall in line with his fellow dictator there in Russia, Vladimir Putin. And it also indicates how China could be brought onto its biblically prophesied collision course with that European power. And I think what we saw on Sunday with the removal of the two-term limit, that really shows just how close this future biblically prophesied clash could be. So it's really sobering in terms of Bible prophecy and very significant.
When you think about the extent of the warfare that's going to take place, the size of the force that these Asian nations are going to mount, and how this is going to unfold, where you're going to have, you know, hundreds of millions who are thrown into battle, you can see it would take very determined and very authoritative leadership to bring that about. And it would also require a committed populace, that you would have to have people who were very much willing to devote their lives to carrying out the vision of their leaders. You certainly see that happening in Russia with, even though maybe in Russia, I don't know what your view is, but it seems like there's a little more outspoken criticism of Putin coming from some quarters. The government has obviously taken some pretty strong steps to minimize that there as well. In China, you don't hear nearly the same kinds of voices, opposition in that country. But both of those countries, you really do have very strong public support for their leaders.
That's exactly right. It's difficult to get a trustworthy opinion poll in China for their support of their leadership. But for the most part, the populace is behind the Communist Party, and they're behind Xi Jinping. And yes, in both China and Russia, there are people on the fringes that may say, we're concerned about this. We would like to be democratic. We would like to have the voice of the people reflected in government policies.
Well, in Russia, there have even been some public protests against it that have happened in various cities within the country.
Yes, that's right. Especially as we approach the election coming up in mid-March, there have been fairly widespread protests in Russia, but it's not enough to really move the dial on Putin's 75-80% popularity rating, which is confirmed even by Western opinion polls and things like that. There are always going to be dissenters and people who don't buy into the government's vision. But it's very interesting, though, that as the people of China and Russia look at the Western world and they see the immorality, they see the confusion in the leadership, they see a lot of polarity between the right and the left, and they just see these countries, especially the US and the UK, just kind of falling apart and very little unity. And they say, democracy may not be for us. And so that's why I think you don't see mass protests enough to actually affect a revolution. And it's very unlikely, I believe, that there would be a revolution. Just because for the most part, these people buy into the vision of Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping, and that will make those end time armies that much fiercer because they'll be manned by individuals who agree with what they're fighting for.
That's pretty fascinating. Anywhere that you would send listeners to for more information on this? And you're working on an article on this, I presume, as well?
Yes. Yeah, hopefully by Wednesday we'll have an article up on thetrumpet.com about this. And then I would also refer listeners back to our January 2018 issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet. The cover says King Me, and it's just about this global return to authoritarian leadership. And we go across the whole globe and just show how this is happening more and more across so many nations and just pinpoint some of the worrying implications of this trend.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about China's Communist Party proposing to eliminate presidential term limits. He has this article that'll appear on thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that. And again, go check out that Trumpet issue, January 2018, about the rise in strongmen around the world. Thanks a lot for your time, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Last Friday, the White House made a surprise announcement after having said in December that it planned to move America's embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Many thought that it would take years to make that a reality, but last Friday it was announced that America plans to open a temporary embassy in Jerusalem in time for the 70th anniversary of the creation of the State of Israel on May 14th. So they are moving very fast. And we're moving very fast as well with events taking place with our crew in Jerusalem. It's been a busy week there. We're going to get all caught up to speed by talking to the man overseeing day-to-day operations there, trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall. Hello, Brent.
Hello, how are you?
Doing great. It's great to talk to you again here. We're going to talk about the embassy move in a little bit, but let's just have a recap of the week you've had. Tell us about your perspective on the announcement about the Isaiah Bulla.
Yeah, it was a extremely busy week. We had trumpet writer Brad McDonald down in Jerusalem. He was conducting a number of interviews with Dr. Eilat Mazar and also some of the family of Dr. Eilat Mazar, just gathering a lot of research on the Mazar family and how they came into archaeology. And his time down here did coincide also with the release last Thursday to the public of the Isaiah Bulla that people listening to the radio program or KPCG are extremely familiar with that, probably more than most, just because we've had a lot of coverage on thetrumpet.com about that as well. It's what has been kind of interesting to see is just how much traction it's had over here. Dr. Mazar was on live television last night talking about the Isaiah Bulla. Today or early yesterday, there was another story on the Jerusalem Post. I have it here in front of me. It was very interesting because it was entitled this, Ophel Excavation Director Discusses Biblical Discoveries, Temple Mount. And it's basically a non-story, but they're trying to ride this way from the Isaiah Bulla, and they're just saying, here's some thoughts of Dr. Elot Mazar, and we're going to put it in our paper. Kind of showing just some more of the traction that it's had over here. It was on the front page of the Jerusalem Post, the first time that Dr. Mazar has had a discovery on the front page of the Jerusalem Post. Just walking down the street and saw a copy of the paper. I was like, wow, there is the massive Isaiah Bulla in, you know, above the fold.
Why do you suppose, what is it about the Isaiah Bulla that is drawing this kind of attention? As opposed to so many of the other things that she's discovered. I mean, she's got an impressive resume, yet this is maybe getting a little more interest.
Well, it's probably a number of things. I would think, number one, I feel like biblical archaeology is kind of resurfacing in Israel. Obviously, excavations have always taken place, yet month after month, you have a new discovery. I think it was a month and a half ago or 2 months ago, there was this discovery of the governor of Jerusalem, another inscription or bulla from King Hezekiah's time, the same time period that was discovered. That got a lot of press coverage. And then to top that off, we have Isaiah the prophet, who has a biblical book named after him. We could compare it in a way, or compare the reaction to the Hezekiah bulla when that was released. Obviously, King Hezekiah, king of Judah, this is an important figure historically, yet I probably think that Isaiah is more readily in the consciousness than even King Hezekiah would be. And so for that reason, maybe it got more press. A lot of international press as well. Dr. Mazar was surprised by that. Her phone was ringing off the hook, hearing from international press. She was, in some ways, she's kind of frustrated being interviewed by some ignorant journalists with some of the questions that they asked, just because they might not cover biblical archaeology and then they want to do a story on this. And so they're calling her up. And anyway, that's beside the point. Nevertheless, the important point is that they're calling her and they want to put this in their papers. I even saw that it was on RT, Russia Today even posted it, a story about the Isaiah Bulla. And so you do have this huge, many news agencies deciding that this is an important story in Israel, abroad. And of course, we were the ones that got to put together the documentary for that. You can find that documentary now. That's on YouTube on a number of different articles. A lot of these newspapers have added that documentary to their articles after the fact. We even had British journalist Melanie Phillips wrote it up after a tip from us. And she was gracious enough to include our article in her post about it, as well as just connecting it to the church, Philadelphia Church of God, and also Herbert W. Armstrong College. So it was an amazing day on Thursday. It was also the day of the birth of my son.
Yes, congratulations. That's another big news out of our Jerusalem crew.
It was one of those things that, because obviously we knew that this date at the trumpet, we knew that the Isaiah Bulla was going to be released, and we tried to really coordinate our timing of that. It was 7 a.m. Jerusalem time is when it was going to be released. My wife was in labor during that, so I'm trying not to check thetrumpet.com while my wife is in labor to see it, if it's gone up or not. But I did hit refresh a couple of times to see it go up. So it was a great day all up. I had some people here wondering why I decided to call my son Nehemiah instead of Isaiah.
Well, anyone who's known you for any length of time was not surprised by the name of your son.
Right. Nehemiah's been on the cards for a while, but I considered Isaiah just because of the day releasing the bullet. But so just a big week all around. Dr. Mazar has been extremely happy on the excavation site the last week, just because of the release, because it was so favorably taken by the press. There have been a couple of stories that have rolled in over the last couple of days after the release, talking about why it's not the Isaiah, or why it might not be the Isaiah Bulla. And with all of those archaeologists that are putting forth that theory, Dr. Mazar has addressed all of their arguments already in her article, and even Brad McDonald's article addresses those as well. But just a really positive week for Jerusalem archaeology, for Dr. Mazar, for us. And that's not even talking about the actual excavations that are currently taking place.
Well, let's talk about those now. We're probably about 2/3 of the way through this dig. Anything that you can report to us?
Yeah, the excavation is going very well within the two areas. It's funny that we're 2/3 the way through, and it seems like there's so much left to do. They always say that the most important finds in an excavation happen in the last couple of days. And so we're hopeful for that. In the cave where we are excavating, this cave or cistern, even as we reported back in 2013, it's what we're discovering is just this a snapshot of the period right when the Romans had besieged the city, right when Jerusalem, the Jews, were facing Titus and Vespasian and I think four Roman legions. And this cave was kind of used as a hideout, we think, in those last days of the siege. We've even found a lot of coins, just a really interesting amount of coins from that period as well, from like the fourth year of the revolt, as they're called. I don't want to get ahead of Dr. Mazar's reporting at all on that, but we are looking at this. So far, we're looking at this snapshot of a people that are trying to hide from the Romans, I think, and maybe perhaps living in this cistern for a while. And so we have lots of different pottery from that period. I'm not satisfied yet with the discoveries in the excavation. I think there is much more to come up.
The idea being that the layer that you're excavating right now and the history that you're uncovering right now would be resting on top of perhaps more ancient history.
Yeah, for sure. This was used as some type of water holding facility or for some drainage maybe. And so the layers related to that use are underneath where we're currently excavating. I think we have just got down to, perhaps even in the next couple of days, down to this layer that should have more ancient remains, probably into the Hasmonean period, the period of the Maccabees, the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, that we're going to get down into that time period. But right now we're still dealing with the 70 AD, which it's wonderful. In a way, it's wonderful to recreate that history because Josephus talks about it a lot. He was there as an eyewitness to the destruction of Jerusalem. And so we're seeing the pages of Josephus. It's not the Bible, but the pages of Josephus are being brought back to life through what we're discovering.
Boy, that is really fascinating, Brent. Appreciate you bringing us up to speed on that. Just to wrap things up, let's talk a little bit about this embassy move. Pretty interesting announcement here last Friday. A whole lot more urgency, I guess, on the part of the American government. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Mr. Trump, of course, he campaigned on the promise, as all presidential hopefuls have, that he would move the embassy, the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He said, I guess it was back December 6th, that he was going to do that. And at the time, he said it would take years, perhaps even till 2020. Then later on, we had Vice President Pence come out when he was visiting Israel, I believe it was last month, he said that it would probably be 2019. And then here we have last week, last Friday, it was kind of slipped under the table in a memo that we're actually going to do it in May. So we're going to bring up the schedule till May and coinciding with Israel's independence 70 years from 1948. I think May 14th is the date that they're going to move it. And while this isn't obviously a new embassy being constructed, they're going to use the current consulate that they have in Jerusalem that's in the Arnona neighborhood, which is probably about a half mile from here where I'm recording this right now. I've been there a number of times to get visas, where the Jerusalem U.S. visas are dealt with. And so they're basically going to move the plaque. I remember Melanie Phillips, when she was talking at Armstrong Auditorium, I believe it was last year, she said, it's not that difficult to move the embassy. All you need to do is change the plaque on the front of the building. Well, that's what they're going to do.
she was suggesting that they just do it in the middle of the night. Don't make an announcement, just move it. But they've made quite a to-do about it.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised that it was less of a major announcement, this bringing it forth to May, than what we've seen previously. But it's interesting because this facility in Arnona, or southern Jerusalem, is right on the border between East and West Jerusalem. They're going to look for another facility in West Jerusalem to where to build one, but this will be the temporary house of the ambassador, United States ambassador to Israel. He'll be here moving his office shortly, perhaps in May.
How are the Israelis responding? And what about the Arabs and even the Europeans?
Yeah, so we have, obviously, the Israelis are happy with this. The prime minister is very happy. He's going to make his way to Washington, D.C. Sometime next month, early next month in March, and to discuss it. And the Palestinians were upset by this because May 14th or May 15th for them is Nabka Day, or the Catastrophe Day, because they celebrate or they memorialize this each year, because this was the day that Israel became a state, and that was the catastrophe in the Middle East. And so that's what they'll be celebrating. So their response has been, how dare Mr. Trump decide to do this as kind of a poke in the eye to the Palestinians on this day. The Europeans met with the Arab League, or many of the leaders of the Arab League, just this week, or yesterday, I believe it was, or 2 days ago. Federica Mogherini met with them. They discussed how she said that they see eye to eye, the European Union does, with the Arab states, that they are against this move, still against this move. She talked about how Mr. Trump, while he wants to bring a peace plan forward, this is not the right time to bring a peace plan forward because of all the kerfuffle or the attention that he's getting now with this Jerusalem move. So they're against it, but it looks like it's going forward at an extremely accelerated time frame.
Why do you suppose America is in such haste to do this?
There are a number of theories out there. The one I like best, it seems that Mr. Trump wants to hasten his Middle East peace plan. I believe he wants to get to the next step quicker. He said when he made this announcement, that back when he said he's going to move it in December, that this takes Jerusalem off the table, that we're going to just deal with that and get that out of the way, and then we can focus on the other issues. Well, maybe it wasn't going to take it off. He realized it wouldn't take it off the table if he didn't actually move it. And so for the next few years, you would still have this lingering. Bringing it forth to May means the embassy is moved. Let's focus on the next step for Mr. Trump's peace plan, which is interesting because what is that going to be? A number of commentators in the Middle East have talked about that Trump is going to give something to the Israelis, which is moving the United States embassy, and then he's going to give something to the Palestinians. And if you give something to the Palestinians, you require something of the Israelis. You are asking something of the Israelis that they are willing to give up. And so instead of waiting for a long time for that decision of what that's going to be, I think we could see that as early as May.
So you're thinking, you're kind of waiting for the other penny to drop. If this is the concession that he's making to the Israelis, and now he has said things to the effect of, we can't really do any kind of a deal with the Palestinians until they prove themselves willing to willing to participate in this process. And it seems like he's, you know, basically saying what we've seen to this point hasn't been acceptable, but there have been some who have said all the Palestinians have to do is make a feint toward some kind of negotiation or some kind of a concession, and then all of a sudden they're going to have the American government on their side. Trump does seem to be very eager to resolve this situation, and you do wonder what kind of dramatic move may he make in conceding to the other side if they proved themselves willing to do to work with him.
Yeah, I think that's what we're exactly what we're waiting to see in the very near future now because of this, the movement of the date. Daniel Pipes wrote in his article, I think it was a couple weeks ago, he said that Mr. Trump intends to exact an unspecified price from Israel for the recognition, stating that Israel will pay for that. That's what he has said. They're going to pay for that decision. That might have been who the quote that you were referring to. And then he said the American door is permanently open to the Palestinians, and when they wise up, some fabulous gift awaits them in the White House. He might pass that along pretty soon. Daniel Pipes' words are those. He's seeing that. He's written on the Middle East probably for as long as I've been alive. And so he's pretty wise to what could happen. And so he's saying that just look out, come May now, that there might be some fabulous gift awaiting the Palestinians. That's the big thing. Jerusalem, the focus on Jerusalem is not going away. With this decision to move it up, move the embassy move to May, it is just going to surround Jerusalem with more attention this year, in the coming months, rather than waiting for a couple of years.
Well, we'll definitely keep our eyes on it. We certainly appreciate all of the work that you're doing over there and keeping us up to speed, not only with these world events, but also those that you're personally involved in. Congratulations on the birth of your son. We're very excited for you and your family. And we just look forward to hearing from you the next time. Brent, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You ever enjoy a tasty meal at a restaurant and then not feel so good afterward, maybe even end up in bed for a couple of days? We naturally expect that the food we eat has been grown, stored, and handled properly, but food poisoning is a real problem affecting quite a lot of people. What causes it? What can you do to protect yourself against it? To talk about this, we have from his office in British Columbia, registered holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian. Hello, Jörg.
Hello there.
How common is food poisoning?
Oh, it's actually quite common. The American food supply is actually considered the safest in the world, but there's still between 40 and 80 million cases of foodborne illnesses a year. Hmm. And a lot of people don't know that. And that's, there's about 128,000 hospitalizations because of it. And about 9,000 deaths annually, the FDA records. So it's, I think it's about one in six that the stats say get it annually. So it's quite a number of cases.
Well, how severe? 9,000 deaths, that's quite a lot of deaths. How severe, and how do you recognize when you've got food poisoning?
Well, as someone who's had it twice in her lifetime, it's nasty. There's no doubt you have food poisoning because you're going to have nausea, you're going to have vomiting, you're going to have cramps, and there could be further complications. That's just if you're fortunate. And I was younger, I had it twice, and it left me on the floor for a couple of days almost. I mean, it depending on the bug that you get, but it can lead to even further complications, and it's not a normal circumstance. You pretty well can trace it to something that you've done, but you just might not know where you've contracted the bug, but you will know you're sick.
So what causes it? What sort of problems, mishandling of food that create this type of thing?
Well, that's the thing. There's roughly around 200 bugs that, bacteria, anything mishandling of food that can cause it. And, we go out and we go eat in restaurants. We pretty well put ourselves at the mercy of the people handling our food. And it's the same as when we handle our own food. If we go out on a hot day and we don't put the put their food together correctly, you know, we might put hot food with cold food. We might leave it out in the sun too long. We might handle it, food that's been touched with one utensil, and then you touch a fresh food and such. So there's quite a few ways that we can get it, but most of it, according to statistics, is when we eat out. So it's a giant industry today. We know that we're eating, the average person eats out between 2 and 4 times a week. And so when you go to a restaurant, you're asking those people to keep you safe. And in a lot of cases, that's not happening. Now, when it does happen, when you do get food illness, then, like I said, the further failures can be quite catastrophic, you know. So we do have to be careful, because the government says you can have kidney failure, you can have brain and nerve damage, and as we stated, it can even result in death. In essence, food poisoning can do long-term health damage, depending on what type of bug, the severity, and the cause.
Any other long-term side effects that can emerge from these?
Well, it's mainly health-related. I mean, the end result is, you know, we have to be really careful, because it can result in death. But we know that there's statistics showing that even arthritis now can be a cause of that. So a lot of our organs, let's say we're over a case of food poisoning within 2 to 3 days, maybe 4 days, and we think it's okay now, but that might be the initial stages. Now we can affect our organs with this. So statistics show that, you know, you can have catastrophic health results from this, and it can affect your brain, it can affect your organs. And now I was quite surprised to show that even arthritis can be a result of this. So if we're looking at 1 in 6 annually getting this illness, and we're having an explosion of arthritis, well, perhaps this is something that is a cause. Might not be a primary cause, but it's one of the contributing factors.
So people are eating out more than they ever have before. It seems like people are depending on food service professionals to provide more and more of their nutrition. Is this causing food poisoning incidents to go up?
Well, it would sure be a contributing factor. I mean, as a nutritionist, I always counsel people not to eat out so much. I mean, that's just a thing. We're relying on a food industry that relies on an intake of money, our money. With that, you get human nature, and you get people sidestepping safety rules. You get employees not washing their hands and such. Food is stored improperly, you know, and then that's the reason that a lot of food has all these preservatives, especially in the industry, the restaurant industry. I actually worked in that industry, and you can have a salad that looks the same 2 weeks later. It's preserved really well. It just doesn't wilt a lot in that industry. But in that kitchen, a lot goes on. It's quite hectic, and food gets dropped. Food gets handled with the wrong utensils that have been left out. Sanitary problems, you know, people not washing their hands, touching stuff, and having colds and such. All that gets passed on, and those unwitting consumers sitting out there in their seats, they have no idea what now happened. And the workers themselves might not know themselves either, but the statistics say that is the primary cause. So knowing that, just with the health reasons themselves, with the food not being the healthiest, now we have on top of that, that we might get sick.
Right. So this is obviously something that government regulations are intended to prevent. This is happening in spite of that. Why is that?
Well, because for 70 years, we had an antiquated, or the U.S. had an antiquated Food Safety Act. And really what happened, they addressed that in 2010 in Congress, and they passed the new act, the Food Safety Modernization Act, which was quite revolutionary. They recognized that it was going crazy with all these illnesses. And so this was a major overhaul of federal food safety. And it put an emphasis on prevention because they could, they really reacted to outbreaks before. So an outbreak would happen and they would step in and try to react and see what was responsible and trace it back. And this new system now, it's supposed to prevent it in the first place. So an example was that just right before that act passed was one of the deadliest outbreaks in the history of the U.S. And the Peanut Corporation of America, the president was actually the first person sent to prison for selling tainted food. And he did that knowingly. And it was quite a large case. And as many as 20,000 people were sick in there. And 9 died. So you can see why Congress would look at that and say, you know, this is spiraling out of control. Now, this law took about 6 years to roll everything out compliance. And in 2017, supposedly, all manufacturers, all importers are online with this. We're now we have the safety systems in place. It's called full implementation of rule compliance. So, and part of that act is also the Foreign Supplier Verification Program, which is for importers. And they now have to prove that their suppliers have safe food coming in. So that's a critical addition to the act because the U.S. imports 15% of their food. And that includes 50% of fresh fruit, 20% of vegetables, and 80% of seafood from over 200 countries. So you have to understand, they don't all have the same safety mechanisms in place as we do. And you've got thousands of crates of food, thousands, hundreds of thousands sitting in ports, and they have to inspect them all. So this was a critical piece of legislation that was needed for the country.
Mm-hmm. So it's been implemented. Is this going to solve our problem? Do you expect the incidence of food poisoning to go down now?
No. They might go down. Well, I won't say no. They will go down from before, of course. But even with the full implementation of all of this, with us importing more and more, it's almost impossible to have compliance from all these companies. I mean, you've got this FDA, this behemoth government agency that has to verify hundreds of thousands of importers. Like take Kraft Heinz, for example. It has thousands of suppliers. Now it has to turn up the heat on all its importers. It has to have all these protocols and procedures in place. And that's going to be difficult. But imagine trying to manage that information. That's going to be almost impossible for that one company.
Yeah. Well, you know, just thinking about this government regulation along the lines of what you're talking about, it seems like that's not necessarily as effective as just the companies defending their own brand name, restaurant chains and so on, that there's a certain amount of self-regulation that tends to happen within a free market that that prevents this from exploding into even a much bigger problem. If a brand name begins to, you know, we've seen this happen, say, like with Chipotle restaurants. Once it gets out that they have problems with their kitchen, that people are getting sick from their food, then this tends to really stifle the amount of consumers that are going to that restaurant in order to eat from them. The government only has so much. I mean, if you're just looking at the scale of what you're talking about, what the government can actually accomplish in terms of inspecting the food, using these regulations in order to prevent these problems, you can see that it would definitely have to be a certain amount of combination of these. But that said, obviously, there's going to be some of these things that slip through. You have any suggestions for the consumer to protect ourselves to prevent this type of thing happening from us?
Absolutely. We really have to do that because, I mean, can we rely on such a large agency to which really looks at 80% of our food supply, or sorry, the U.S. food supply? Can we rely on that agency to keep everybody safe? No. Can we rely on the self-regulation of the industry? To a degree, it works, yes, but that's really what's been happening. And anytime you get human nature involved, you're going to get greed involved, and then you get all these problems. So we really have to protect ourselves. So like I said, the majority of food poisoning comes from restaurants and commercial food businesses. So my best your best recourse would be not to eat out too often. If you do get sick from eating out, usually you have to report it to the local health authorities. But now they have crowdsourcing websites. There's one that I looked at, iwaspoisoned.com. And it's really neat because within an hour, they can report an outbreak at, say, a Chipotle restaurant, rather than taking days or weeks for the government to step in and to really report this. And then so consumers can visit this and say, wow, there's an outbreak. I'm going to avoid that really quickly. So that's one way that we can look at it. At home.
So you go check iwaspoisoned.com before you go to see if there were any recent reports from the restaurant you're about to visit.
Absolutely. Yeah. You want to see which restaurants were affected, what type of food, you know, what times. I mean, you can put all that information in there. Even the what the manager said to you, you know, if they were helpful, if they're trying to make sure that there's no more further outbreaks. It's really neat. I didn't know about this myself until I looked into it. And so if you have such a website, you're going out to a major chain, you might want to check that chain and see what their health record is. If it's good, then you have a better chance of not being poisoned.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, how do they prevent the competitor across the street from reporting poisonings all the time?
Exactly. And I think what they do there is they don't rely on one. So you can't just say, yes, you know, such and such a restaurant gave me food poisoning. They really look for patterns. And if the patterns add up, so if you have three, four, five people getting poisoned over the course of, you know, say a couple of years even, that's a pattern that it would look at. And they'd say, this might not be a good chain to go there because they're not really doing anything. They're not putting in any steps to prevent you getting sick. So yes, they do look at that.
The main advice is make your own food as much as you can, and then you can control the quality to make sure that you're getting what you're asking for.
Right. Make your own food. The CDC says cleanliness, proper refrigeration, cooking thoroughly, keeping your utensils clean and such. And as well, I would recommend make sure you look at your local sources of food, your local farmers. Take the time to go there, inspect, look at their facilities and say, is this the food that I want to buy and eat local? And that's just an old adage in the nutrition industry. Eat in your local town. Don't buy so much from foreign sources. And that really keeps you a lot safer.
We've been talking with registered holistic nutritionist York Martin about food poisoning. He has written an article. It's going to appear on thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that online. Appreciate your time, as always, York.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Recently at Herbert W. Armstrong College, we had our annual speech banquet. We heard 9 speeches from our students, and I want to share one of these with you. It's given by Gianni Welsh, one of our freshmen. He shared a lesson that he learned at a high school classroom about why it's important to reach out to the reclusive kid in the back of the room. Here's his speech.
Thank you, Mr. Brett, and hello to everyone around the world. He was the loner. The social pariah. He did all that he could to avoid uncomfortable situations with another human being. He joined class at the last possible moment, only to leave first before the masses fled the hallways. As the other students mingled and laughed with each other, there he sat at the back. What if you were given the opportunity to perhaps help change someone's life, and all you had to do was simply have a conversation with that person? Would you take it? Today, I'm going to share with you a lesson I learned about prejudice. Now, what is prejudice? Well, as you can probably infer from the way it's spelled, it is a prejudgment or preconceived notion that someone makes that isn't rooted of their own experience. So depending on our backgrounds or the way we've been raised, it can be easy to kind of view people through a foggy glass that's been influenced by our views, ideas, or experience. So in my intro, I asked the question, what if you were given the opportunity to help change someone's life, and would you take it? Now, this situation kind of arose during my senior year at Boulevard Academy, and I love being around people. I like socializing, talking, and being up in front of people. But there's a certain student that attended there that really deeply impacted my life. I noticed that in the classes that we were in together, he always was by himself, isolated. A lot of the students just made fun of him, teased him about how he looked, how he dressed. And even the teachers, given his track record, would soon think that he was going to be a high school dropout. So I kind of let that negativity that surrounded him to kind of shape how I thought of him, how I viewed him, and therefore I was expressing a form of prejudice without even getting to know this young man. But as time went by, and I was able to talk to him a little, hi there, hello, how are you doing? He kind of opened up and shared with me some of his background that really changed how I even view my interactions with my family and friends to this day. Now, to give you some of that background, he was a young black man, probably about 18, 19 when I met him, and was the youngest of five siblings. Now, at age 3, his father left him and his family, and his mother just left, never came back. And at age 7, his mother, due to the stress, due to having to try to raise 5 children, just ended up giving up on him and putting him up for adoption. And he told me that the last thing that he ever heard from his mother was, "You won't amount to anything, and you are a waste of my time." Now just imagine as a 7-year-old that your own mother said that to you. Now I have loving parents, a loving family, and a lot of supporting people that have really helped change who I am, but I could never imagine that, you know, my own father leaving or my mother saying that I'm not worth your time at such a young age. But because of that, he hopped around to different foster homes and developed a more like introverted personality, as you can tell. He felt that nobody could hear him and that nobody really cared about him. And so this really impacted the way he thought about his life and the way he conducted himself and was more reserved as a student. So as we began to talk and, you know, just really get to know him, we were able to kind of, you know, let go of the negativity and focus more on the positives. And this experience taught me a valuable lesson, and that was that the quality or character of another person cannot be judged by their outward appearance. Now, that might be something that we all think of as, yeah, obviously, but how many times do we see ourselves maybe move into a camp or to some type of event and, you know, we saw somebody that dressed a different way or had a different hairstyle or maybe was secluded in the back by themselves and thought, oh, they must be a loser, or maybe not to that extent, but immediately thought that they're not worth our time to go and interact with them. And one of the themes that we've really been focusing on here at AC as of late is unity. And prejudice really destroys that unity, whether it's intentional or not. Now, down the line, it was towards my graduation, and the student handed me a letter, and it was very powerful, and I'm going to share that with you. And he said, "Gianni, before I met you, I felt like quitting, and many times even contemplated taking my own life. But you helped me see that my life has value, and that my education is important. I will not quit. I will fight, and I will finish graduating high school. Thank you for being someone I can look up to. You are a true friend." Now, what this young man doesn't know is that it wasn't my doing, but God's. God was the one that placed me in his life at that particular time to help this young man out. When we treat people the way we have been taught, the way the ministers and our teachers are developing us into leaders, then we will see them blossom, and you will see that they will notice that, because you are a light. We are all different. But without God and His truth, it doesn't matter. I would have been just like the other students, teasing him, picking on him about the way he looked, the way he dressed, the way he talked. And that's the most important thing to remember. In the world tomorrow, we are going to be dealing with the oddballs, the outcasts, the pariahs. Are we willing to really take a step forward and give them that attention, to really show them that there is a better way of life? We are going to be dealing with people that have a lot of different challenged backgrounds. We are the teachers of the world tomorrow. Are we ready to raise their ruins?
I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests, Jeremiah Jacques, Brent Noctegal, and Jorg Mardian. And special thanks to Gianni Welsh for giving me permission to use his speech. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Aristotle. The worst form of inequality is to try to make unequal things equal. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.